Lecture 11, Celestial Buddhas and Bodhisattvas.
In our last lecture on the Mahayana, we talked about the Bodhisattva ideal as an opportunity for the human beings like ourselves to pursue Buddhahood, to achieve the ideal that was embodied by the Buddha Shakyamuni. And I read some examples of the Bodhisattva ideal from Buddhist literature that talked about human beings just like us. Vimalakirti, pretty rarefied human being in truth, but somebody that we could aspire to be ourselves. There was the queen, Shrimala, the young man, Sudana. These are all figures in Mahayana literature that are meant to open up the Bodhisattva ideal to everybody. And I suppose part of imagining ourselves as being a Bodhisattva is not so much to look at those great scriptural ideals that have come down to us in Mahayana literature, but simply to imagine ourselves, simple people that we are, aspiring in some way to help others and to feel that kind of rush of enthusiasm, motivation perhaps, that comes from imagining that we could become Buddhas too, like the great Buddha who was the founder of the Buddhist tradition. But I also mentioned at the end of the lecture that the Mahayana vision of the universe expanded dramatically. It wasn't just a small group of monks imitating the ideal of a human being, the human being Siddhartha Gautama, Shakyamuni Buddha, but began to imagine themselves as actors and players on a drama that was really cosmic in scope. And what that means for us is that the Mahayana begins to imagine a universe that is populated not just by human bodhisattvas like us, like you and me, but by celestial bodhisattvas and Buddhas who have infinitely greater powers than we have, who have the ability to intervene in this world and save people as if they were gods and goddesses. These are advanced practitioners, you might say, of the Bodhisattva path, who have reached the 8th or the 9th or the 10th stages in the 10 stages of the Bodhisattva path that I mentioned last time, and they've achieved extraordinary superhuman powers. These powers make it possible for celestial bodhisattvas to reside in the heavens, hence the name celestial. They're up there in the heavens. And it makes it possible, these powers make it possible for them to function as the Buddhist equivalent of the Hindu gods, because we're still operating here within the world view and the religious system of traditional India. Buddhists insist, though, that these great bodhisattvas have gone so far beyond the Hindu gods in their power and in their understanding of reality that it's really not appropriate to think of them as being even gods at all. So what we do technically when we speak about the celestial bodhisattvas of the Mahayana is to call them, I suppose, Buddhist deities, or call them simply celestial bodhisattvas in order to distinguish them from the Hindu gods. And what I'd like to do in this lecture is give you some indication of what these celestial bodhisattvas are like and how people have related to them in the practices of Mahayana devotion. There are many of them, of course, as the universe worldview of the Mahayana expanded. It became populated by all sorts of celestial bodhisattvas, some of them appearing only in a few instances in Mahayana literature. But there are a few great celestial bodhisattvas that are worth mentioning because you encounter them really quite widely in the Buddhist world. The first of these is the celestial bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara. Avalokiteshvara's name is probably, well, perhaps you'll be happy to hear this, the most complicated name that we'll mention in the course of all of these lectures. It's made up of two parts, the word Ishvara, which means Lord, and the word Avalokita, that means to look down. So the image you have of Avalokiteshvara is a great celestial embodiment of compassion, standing up there in the heavens and looking down on the people in this world and feeling a sense of compassion for them. Often in the texts you read about Avalokiteshvara's tears, that he weeps as he sees the suffering of the people in this world. In the Lotus Sutra, a text that I talked a little bit about last time, Avalokiteshvara is described as being a protean deity, a deity who takes on all sorts of different forms in order to manifest compassion to people in this world, especially to people who call on his name. So this idea of invoking the compassion of Avalokiteshvara often is involved in the simple practice of calling on the name of the deity himself. Again, this is one of these features in religion that's really easy to take for granted. You know, I say to you in the flow of a lecture, oh, ho-hum, you know, Mahayana practitioners call on the name of Avalokiteshvara and he responds by receiving them with his compassion. But this simple practice actually leads us in an interesting way, I think, into the heart of the Mahayana. I sometimes think that the most basic form of religious practice, especially in a theistic religious tradition, although it also applies here in the Mahayana, is simply to call on the name of the deity and expect the deity in some way to respond, or at least to meditate in some way on the presence of the deity and the deity's concern for you. I felt this really strongly once when I was sitting with my daughter. I guess these experiences come often when you're with people you care about in places that are a little bit different from where you normally live. This was in a hotel in India called the Lake Palace Hotel in Udaipur. It's a very beautiful white hotel that sits in the middle of a lake, and we were on the terrace of that hotel in the evening. There were green parrots flying around. The sky was blue. It was an exquisitely beautiful scene. And from a temple across the lake, we could hear a chant, a simple chant. A man was saying, "Hey Ram, Hey Ram, Hey Ram, Hey Ram." In another language, it sounds like a complicated, almost secret chant, but it actually is really simple. It just means, "Oh God, oh God, oh God, oh God." It's that basic expression of human piety in the face of the divine. And that makes its appearance here in the Mahayana tradition, here, really for the first time in our lectures on Buddhism. The tradition tells us in the Lotus Sutra that if we call on the name of Avalokiteshvara, if we say, it's harder than saying, "Hey Ram," if we say, "Hey Avalokiteshvara, Hey Avalokiteshvara," that we will achieve some kind of connection to the compassion of that great deity. Now, it's also possible to invoke the compassion of Avalokiteshvara by chanting a mantra, a technical phrase that invokes the power of that and embodies the power of that great celestial figure. The mantra is Om Mani Padme Hum. Some of you may have heard it. It's conceivable that it has floated like some cosmic influence through your world. When I speak about this with students in my own classroom, we talk about Buddhism at 9 in the morning, and you have to have just about any device available to you to try to wake people up. We spend a lot of time chanting this from deep in the gut where Buddhist chant is supposed to come from. So we could try this, I guess, although I won't be able to hear you chanting back at me. Just say, "Oh Mani Padme Hum, Oh Mani Padme Hum, Oh Mani Padme Hum," and imagine that you're like some Tibetan monk in a monastery in the mountains invoking the power of Avalokiteshvara. It's an important phrase throughout the Mahayana world, and particularly in the world of Tibet, where it is not just chanted, but inscribed on the surface of prayer wheels, that you often see Tibetan devotees or Tibetan practitioners spinning, inscribed on flags that are flown from temples and flown from mountain passes, and carved on rocks, on money stones, as they're called, to invoke the power of Avalokiteshvara's compassion. Avalokiteshvara is important in Tibet, and you could almost imagine that for Tibetans, they're trying to somehow fill the fabric of Tibet as a physical space with the energy of Avalokiteshvara's compassion embodied in this mantra. Sometimes people translate it as meaning something like, "Ah, the jewel in the lotus." But actually, a mantra is a sacred syllable that has power separate from its meaning, so it's not really necessary even to translate it. It's only important to chant it, and with it comes the power of Avalokiteshvara. Now, in India and Tibet, Avalokiteshvara is a compassionate deity, and you can imagine that Avalokiteshvara had a feminine side as well. Avalokiteshvara's compassion is also associated with Tara, the protectress, a female bodhisattva of compassion. I've got a text in front of me here that invokes Tara. And it might be interesting to just read a couple of lines of it so that you can get a sense of what a devotee might have spoken in order to bring the compassion of Tara present in her or his life. It goes like this. Om, praise to the blessed noble Tara. Your compassion truly extends equally to all beings on the pathways of rebirth. Therefore, I am surely among those whom it embraces. Your unequaled capacity to save beings shines like the sun on the dark passions, the impurities of the whole world. And I too suffer and am tormented. Oh, the impure misdeeds that I have committed. Often Mahayana liturgical statements like this start out with a statement of your own faults, your own sins, as if to say, you are very great, oh, blessed Tara, I am very small. And yet I know somehow that your compassion is directed to me. So make your compassion known to me, because I know it will in some way help me deal with the difficulties of this life. When those who are injured, whose limbs are being fed on by vermin that have attached, this gets pretty grisly here, who have attached themselves to oozing wounds, smelling of flesh, flowing with blood, suppurating with stinking pus, and so on. Maybe I won't read too much more of that line, but you can imagine what it sounds like. To service at your feet, their physical bodies become beautiful like gold, and their eyes like lotuses. Those whose loins are covered with rags, that are torn and dark with dirt, who pick lice and seek food from others in a broken pot, they will gain universal sovereignty over the earth by propitiating you. You can see the devotional logic at work in these words. They almost sound in some way like the Beatitudes in the Gospels. Blessed are the poor, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who suffer in the most grisly ways in this world, because for them, Tara, your compassion is ready and available. In Tibet, under the name of Chenrezi, Avalokiteshvara is thought to be the patron deity of the nation, taking form as the monkey who was the progenitor of the Tibetan race, and also taking form as the Dalai Lama. So you sometimes hear a funny tale about Avalokiteshvara in conversation with the Dalai Lama. For people who know something about him, he's understood to be a manifestation of Avalokiteshvara himself. Sometimes when he's talking to American audiences, he gets all sorts of questions, but one of them has particularly to do with the theory of evolution. I heard the Dalai Lama being asked once, well, you know, Dalai Lama, here in this country, some people, some religious people, have a problem with the idea that we are descended from monkeys. What do you think about that? Dalai Lama says, well, you know, in Tibet, we think that the Tibetan nation is really descended from the union of a monkey and a goddess, so we really don't have any particular problem with the idea of evolution. Well, he never says what he ought to say sometime, as I, the Dalai Lama, was that monkey. I, Avalokiteshvara, was there as that monkey when the Tibetan race began. So Avalokiteshvara is visualized as having a particularly close relationship with Tibet and is embodied and made present in the figure of the Dalai Lama. In China, Avalokiteshvara is known as Guanyin, the one in Chinese who hears sounds. During the Tang Dynasty, Guanyin came to be pictured as a white-robed female deity, like the deity Tara, who was particularly associated with the power to grant children. So people make pilgrimages to the shrines of Guanyin for the prosperity of the family, as I've mentioned before, and also in the hopes that Guanyin will grant them children. Now, Avalokiteshvara is obviously an important deity in the Mahayana world, but there are others too, and I just want to mention a few others for you to be aware of as we track the evolution of the Mahayana tradition throughout the rest of Asia. One of these is the celestial bodhisattva Maitreya. Now, Maitreya is venerated throughout the Buddhist world, in Theravada countries as well as in the Mahayana, as the future Buddha, the next in the line. So he's waiting in a heaven called Tushita, the Tushita heaven. It's a name that means simply the pleasurable heaven, waiting until the situation is ripe in this world for him to come and to start the teaching of Buddhism all over again. But since he's up there in heaven, it's possible for us to invoke his aid. In fact, in some respects, he may be closer to us than other kinds of celestial bodhisattvas and Buddhas because he's poised, as it were, to enter this world. You find that there are remarkable stories of devotion to Maitreya, especially in China, where he seems to have played a particularly important role in devotional practices during a dynasty that we'll come to discuss, the Tang Dynasty. A story that I'm particularly fond of is the story of Xuanzang, an important Chinese Buddhist monk who visited India in the 7th century. When he came down into India, he traveled like other travelers through some pretty sketchy parts of the country. And one time he was floating down the Ganges on his way to visit a monastery down in the southern part of the Ganges Basin. And his group was attacked by pirates. They took off in boats from the shore, grabbed these pilgrims who were out there and brought them to the shore, stole all of their goods. And then, as it turns out, these pirates were devotees of the goddess Durga, who in this period used to receive human sacrifices. And they saw this fat, attractive Chinese monk, and they thought, aha, this is the guy we need. The sacrifice to Durga. So as the story is told, they formed a little mud altar there on the shore of the Ganges, and they tied up Xuanzang and got ready to sacrifice him. And he said to them, I'm telling the tale here as it was told by some of his disciples back in China, he said to them, well, you know, you guys, I'm going to have to collect my thoughts. Could I have just a few moments before you sacrifice me so that I can prepare myself for passage into the next life? He sat down and he meditated. And instead of calming his mind the way we have talked about when we've discussed Buddhist meditation, instead of allowing the thoughts to empty his mind completely, he visualized Maitreya in heaven. So in an imaginative process, he ascended out of this world into Maitreya's throne room and paid homage to him. So he engaged in an act of visualization of Maitreya in his heaven. And at that moment, according to the story, what would happen? You can probably guess it. A great storm came and blew the waters on the Ganges into great waves, and it knocked down the trees, and it knocked the pirates' boats out and washed them away into the river. And the pirates said, who is this guy? Who is this monk that we thought we were going to sacrifice. And the people who were there in the party with him explained, well, you know, he's not just an ordinary guy. He's this really quite accomplished practitioner of Buddhism from China. And the pirates bowed down and said, oh, great monk, please have mercy on us, convert us to Buddhism. And he gave them the five precepts and made them Buddhist converts. Now, how much of that story we really can have great confidence in, I don't know. It's a legendary tale about quite a remarkable traveler, and obviously is told with a great deal of reverence and probably with a fair amount of imagination. But one thing that is important that we can take from it is that it gives us a glimpse of a visualization practice. It's a different kind of meditation than what we've talked about before, and it's a visualization that's associated here with the figure of Maitreya, a celestial bodhisattva who is capable of stepping right into this world and saving somebody from trouble. You can see that this is a powerful new form of practice in Buddhism that has a lot of influence on the way the tradition develops. Another popular and well-known image of Maitreya is as the fat, laughing Buddha in the Chinese tradition. I think for a lot of people who come to the study of Buddhism for the first time, this actually is the Buddha. He's kind of a chubby guy who has a little bit of a smile on his face and is sitting in sort of a relaxed posture. In fact, we see that figure around us quite often in this world. Sometimes it's said in China and Japan that that's actually an image of a monk who wandered through this world carrying in a bag things that he could distribute to people, almost like a Buddhist Santa Claus, I suppose, you know, having everything that anyone needed to remove their suffering in his bag, and in a happy, laughing, jovial way, he would simply provide this to people. It's understood, though, that he was, at that moment, not merely a human being, but a manifestation of Maitreya, and in this form has become an important and very popular image of the presence of Maitreya in this world. Another celestial bodhisattva that I'm particularly fond of, because in a way he is my patron saint, it's the bodhisattva Manjushri. He's the patron saint of scholars. I say saint somewhat facetiously. Let's call him the patron deity or the patron bodhisattva of scholars. He carries a sword in one hand. I guess it's in his right hand. And then he carries a book in his left, the book that embodies the perfection of wisdom. Manjushri is the Buddhist counterpart of the popular Hindu goddess Saraswati, whose festivals are often celebrated by school children across India. So he's the patron saint of wisdom and the protective deity, you might say, of people who study and learn. And I've felt in very interesting ways over the years and working with Tibetan monks, in some way the presence of Manjushri through them. I was working on a particularly difficult text one time and found the thing beginning to become clear to me in my mind. And as we closed the text, the monk that I was working with looked at me and gave me a big grin, and he said, David, Manjushri has smiled on us today. And I can imagine in some way what that might be like. In any case, Manjushri is an important bodhisattva, especially for scholars in the Buddhist tradition. Now, I also should mention that in addition to celestial bodhisattvas, there are celestial Buddhas as well. I said earlier that not everyone is limited to the bodhisattva path. There are beings who reach the end of the path and achieve Buddhahood and achieve this kind of celestial status in the Mahayana tradition. One of the most important of these is the Buddha Amitabha, a name that means infinite light. He also is called Amitayus, or infinite life. The story of Amitabha is that when he was a bodhisattva, he took a vow, made a promise, that when he achieved awakening, when he became a Buddha, he would establish a pure land known as Sukhavati, the pleasurable land. And in that land, anyone could be reborn if they chanted his name with faith. From the descriptions of the land, it's depicted as a place that's full of lotuses, and Amitabha himself sits on a lotus throne. And if we chant the name, or if a devotee chants the name of Amitabha with faith, the devotee will be reborn in a tight lotus bud in that land, and then the light of Amitabha's face will shine on the lotus bud, the lotus bud will open, and the devotee will see Amitabha face to face. Amitabha's vow stipulates that this expression of devotion should take place in the chanting of the name, like the chanting of the name Avalokiteshvara or Tara that we talked about before. The way you do this in Sanskrit, what it sounds like, is to say, Namo Mitabaya Buddhaya. Namo Mitabaya Buddhaya. Mitabaya just means Amitabha, and Buddhaya is Buddha. It's got a dative ending that receives, as it were, the homage that's being expressed by the word namo or namaha. And this is often translated in a somewhat rarefied and technical way as being homage or veneration to Amitabha Buddha. But again, you know, at 9 in the morning in our class on Buddhism at Boston University, we play around with other kinds of translations for this phrase. Namo is not actually a complicated technical word, and it doesn't express a technical form of practice. It's the phrase that you use in India to say hello to somebody. You would greet someone in India by folding your hands in front of you and saying namaste or namaskar. Namaste, homage to you or greetings to you. So we were working with possible translations of Namo Mitabaya Buddhaya a couple of years ago, and we came up with this as a possibility. Hello, Buddha. Especially, I suppose, especially useful, I imagine, at the moment of death, as in one of the classic practices in this tradition, to chant the name of Amitabha Buddha at the moment of death. If you can say Namo Mitabaya Buddhaya with faith at that crucial moment, Amitabha will come to your bedside surrounded by crowds of bodhisattvas and will bear your soul off to the pure land. And what better way to greet Amitabha at that moment than by saying, hello, Buddha. Welcome to this place. Take me to the pure land. Like the invocation of Avalokiteshvara's name, this practice is really a deliberate attempt to open up the possibility of salvation to anybody who approaches the deity with sincere faith. It's a genuine attempt to open the possibility of salvation up to anyone who can approach this celestial being with a sense of sincere aspiration. Now, devotion to Amitabha Buddha, sometimes known as Pure Land Buddhism, has been influential throughout China and Japan. We'll talk about it as Pure Land tradition in Japanese Buddhism, one of the most important varieties of Japanese Buddhism, and also an important variety of Buddhism in North America today. But I think it's important as we encounter it for the first time to ask, really, not where is it found, but in what way is it really related to the kind of Buddhism that we already know. So it seems to me that devotion to Amitabha Buddha takes us about as far away from the tradition of self-reliance that we saw back in the early tradition, and we thought of, I think, for a while anyway, as being one of the fundamental characteristics of Buddhism. The Buddha taught anything. It was the idea that you should rely on your own efforts and you could achieve nirvana for yourself. No one else could do it for you. Now we've all of a sudden, with just a few waves of a magic wand, entered a world where you don't rely on yourself. You rely on the influence of a deity, a celestial Buddha who is infinitely more powerful than you. How did that happen? Is this even Buddhism anymore? Have we entered a world where the Buddhist tradition has now been so deeply transformed that it has become in some way unrecognizable? I'd argue that what we see here is simply an example of the malleability and adaptability of the tradition. Because you can see, in fact, how the logic of the Buddhist tradition has given rise to this new way of thinking about Buddhist life. In two ways, I think. First of all, in the Mahayana tradition, we're not really talking anymore about a single lifetime, one, two, or three lifetimes in the pursuit of nirvana. Now the passage to enlightenment has been stretched out over many, many lifetimes as a bodhisattva comes back into this world to help others. And so there's much more emphasis now, not on perfect wisdom that can come later, but on simply having the faith that gives you access to the beginning of the path. This emphasis on salvation by faith has to do with the importance now of simply entering the path of the bodhisattva. Getting started is more important, really, than anything that may come later. It also is important, of course, not just to rely on your own efforts in the Mahayana, but to receive gratefully the compassion of others. So in this network of compassion in the Mahayana, there's a possibility of salvation now that has a very different character than anything we've seen before and radically changes the flavor of the Buddhist tradition.